Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on May the 12th, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Malankyaputta Sutta. In this sutta, the Buddha is questioned regarding the great existential questions that humanity has been seeking answers for since the beginning of time. The Buddha consistently refused to answer anything that would prove to be a distraction from the goal of the Eightfold Path and would only reinforce ignorance of Four Noble Truths. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
The Malankyaputta, or the also known as the Malankyavada Sutta, it's another sutta where the Buddha is presented with those great existential questions, and he answers them in the same way. The reason why this is a significant sutta is the references that the Buddha makes to different aspects of the Dhamma. The introduction, as Buddhism developed, many of the accommodations and embellishments made to the Buddha's teachings were done to provide answers to these great existential questions. When looked at closely and in the context of Four Noble Truths, many of these questions have an underlying motive of establishing a permanent self in the physical realm or in a speculative non-physical realm. The Kula Malankyavada Sutta. The Buddha was at Jita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. One of the monks of the Sangha, Malankyaputta, was in seclusion when the thought occurred to him, "The Buddha does not give an answer when asked certain questions, such as, is the cosmos eternal or not eternal? Is the cosmos finite or infinite? Does a body have a soul or not? Does an awakened person exist after death, or do they not exist after death? Or do they both exist and not exist, or neither of these?" And that last statement is an often used reconciliatory thought to establish a wrong view in one realm or another, in a physical or a non-physical realm. In other words, if I exist in this realm, fine. What happens to me when I die? I must find a way to establish myself in that. Or the whole idea is of existence is wrong and nothing exists. And it is that final way of looking at things, that it must be, because it can't be this, and it can't be that, it must be both of these things, which is a way of, it's a disingenuous way of looking at what's occurring in front of you, which is what the Buddha taught is reality. If you want to understand your life, you have to be present with what's occurring, and you have to see things as they are occurring in the environment that they're occurring in. And ultimately that comes down to, and the Buddha refers to this here in the other sutras we've been addressing recently, that all things are impermanent. Everything is in a process of becoming. So you can never make a declarative statement about a self in any realm. Malankyaputta decides that, "I don't accept that the Buddha refuses to answer these questions. I will seek him out and ask him about this. If his answers satisfy me, then I will continue as his disciple. If he refuses to answer me, I will leave the Sangha." So that last statement is what many people put on the Buddha and still apply to the Dhamma today, that if it doesn't satisfy my views, if it challenges my views in any way, and if the Buddha or the Dhamma or a teacher can't provide an answer that I find acceptable, then I'm leaving. Of course, that's just a way to protect your views. You don't have to look at them in any other context, and you can just assume that an awakened person's teaching must be false simply because it doesn't agree with your thinking. That evening, Malankyaputta went to the Buddha, and upon greeting the Buddha with a bow, sat to one side. "Great teacher, I have been pondering why you do not provide a satisfying answer to these questions." And he puts those questions to the Buddha. And then he says, "If you can answer these questions based on your knowing, I will remain a disciple. If you cannot answer these questions from not knowing, I will leave the Sangha." The Buddha responds, "Malankyaputta, did I ever tell you or even imply that my teaching would answer these questions or that these questions deserve an answer?" "No, great teacher." "Well then, why are you claiming a grievance or making a demand of me? if you threaten to leave the Sangha unless these questions are answered by me, then you should leave the Sangha. So the Buddha is not engaging in debate and trying to prove the efficacy of his Dhamma. He's simply stating, if you want to know what I teach is true, you have to develop it. And if you're not interested, that's fine. You don't have to. And the Buddha wasn't being insincere or even lacking any compassion. In fact, it's the essence of compassion, especially when you're talking about the Dhamma, to be clear and direct about it. Because any type of, and the Buddha understood this clearly, any type of ambiguity, he knew that an ignorant mind would attach itself to that like a dog to a bone and will hold on to the ambiguity rather than seeing the clarity of his Dhamma. And he speaks directly to that here. The Buddha continues, you are like a man who has been wounded by a poisonous arrow. His friends brought him to a surgeon, but they refused to have the arrow removed until they know who shot the arrow, their poison, their physical attributes, and even what type of bow they use. They further delay the action that will save them by insisting on knowing what type of animal the arrow feathers are from and the type of wood it is composed of. That's the same as saying that I need to understand the underlying motives of what this person is saying. And of course, when you say that, you can only apply your views to those motives. So someone who has great aversion to changing the way they're thinking will start picking apart the Dhamma in that way. Well, where does this come from? Why does it do that? How come it doesn't apply this way? What kind of animal did this come from? Rather than recognizing this person is in distress and this other person says, I can tell you why. All of these questions have nothing to do with the matter at hand. They will die never knowing the answers to these foolish questions, which only prove to be a distraction from what is most important. Whatever your view is of these questions, the right view is dukkha occurs. Craving originates and clinging perpetuates dukkha. Cessation of the process is possible. The Eightfold Path is the path developing cessation. So the Buddha is taking Malankyaputta's and in general the world's confusion about the Dhamma and saying it's the questions that are confusing you. Let go of the questions. And he points Malankyaputta's mind and our minds directly to the Four Noble Truths. That's what he described right here. Dukkha occurs is the first noble truth. Craving originates and clinging perpetuates dukkha. Second noble truth, cessation of the process is possible. Third noble truth, and the Eightfold Path is the path developing cessation. So immediately the Buddha turns Malankyaputta's mind back to the Four Noble Truths, because that's what he taught. And then he declares, I do not answer these questions. He's being very clear about this. I do not answer these questions as they are not fundamental with the goal. There's no reason to get into it. I'm a Dhamma teacher. It's irrelevant to me, these great questions. It's not what I teach. I do not answer these questions because they are not fundamental to the goal. They do not develop disenchantment, dispassion. They do not develop calming or unbinding. They do not develop direct knowledge, or they do not develop awakening. This is why I do not answer these questions. I do make it very clear that, and the Buddha reiterates, dukkha occurs, clinging originates, and clinging continues dukkha. Cessation of this process is possible, and it is the Eightfold Path that develops cessation. And I make this very clear for one purpose. This develops disenchantment, dispassion. It develops calming and unbinding. It develops direct knowledge and awakening. This is why I teach the Dhamma. And Malankyaputta, always remember what I teach and what I do not teach. Mm-hmm. And that is probably the most important line that is intentionally and conveniently overlooked by the mind that says that the Dhamma must be this or it must be that. Or you cannot look at it in a clear and direct way. Always remember what I teach and what I do not teach. Having heard these words, Malankyaputta was satisfied and went on his way. And people asked last Tuesday, what happened to Malankyaputta? He continued to develop the Dhamma and eventually awakened. That's the end of that sutta. The importance of this sutta and these last three, but every sutta the Buddha ever gave, is it points us back to the Four Noble Truths. Remember with Vajragoda and Anuruddha, He used the, first with Vachagoda, the three marks of existence, impermanence, the not-self characteristic and resulting dukkha, and the five clinging aggregates, and he brought those teachings, he taught those teachings rather than getting into debate about these great questions, something that I'm not always that good about. it is so important. The Dhamma is simple and direct. There's nothing terribly confusing about it, except we try to apply it and integrate it into a mind that has its own confused views rooted in ignorance and make it fit those views.
And a mind that's looking for answers to other things.
Yes.
To want to know what happens to the universe, etc., etc.
Yep.
It's not a mind that's looking towards peace. It's not looking towards the teachings of the Buddha. It's looking towards another subject.
Yeah, it's looking for continued self-establishment.
Right. Or asking the Buddha these questions is like asking the Buddha how you play tennis. It's not
exactly. Yes.
He doesn't teach how to play tennis. It's just another form of bringing in outside things to focus on the Dharma, and the Dharma has nothing to do with that. It's nothing to do with playing tennis.
Exactly. It's a perfect analogy. And so if you think about that, and you understand from an awakened point of view, a person coming to you, wanting to understand the truth, but knowing that they are confused and rooted in ignorance, it is the essence of cruelty to introduce something else because you know it'll make them feel good. Give them something simple.
Yeah.
So, well, I feel sorry for this poor soul. I'm not going to push him too hard. I'll teach him how to play tennis, and that'll make him feel good for a few days.
Mm-hmm.
That's the essence of cruelty, isn't it?
Yes.
Because it's continuing that person's ongoing suffering, mm-hmm. and not having the courage to stand up and say, no, it's not that, it's this.
Yes.
And that is the consistency that struck me so hard when I finally started reading what the Buddha was teaching. Because up until that point, I was involved in this all-encompassing, one-thing-fits-all. And it just got more and more confusing because one thing doesn't fit everything. And things are discrete. The great lesson that the Buddha taught, and it's a great understanding of impermanence, is that all things are discrete and all things arise and pass away of their own accord. And it has nothing to do with what else is occurring. There's a universal structure that allows for a physical environment, but that's simply the environment they're in, an impermanent environment. And you had something else?
Also, if the Buddha had answered these outline questions, the lesson that needed to be learned is what the Dharma is, and that lesson would never be learned.
Yes.
Because the kind of minds that we have, if the Buddha taught me how to play tennis, I'd ask the Buddha how to do something else, and my mind would never get back because
Series of distractions.
Yes, you're just putting off looking at what the Dharma is by other distractions.
Yes.
So you would never get round to actually learning what the Dharma is. You know what I mean?
And it's the essence of wrong view, then, isn't it? Because you are now what a Buddhist teacher, an awakened one, taught you that 2 hours of tennis is a good way of awakening.
Mm-hmm.
But that ignorant person taught that because it knew it made you feel good, rather than, and it's the same thing as saying, you know, we're using that analogy, it's the same thing as saying, as teaching, and another thing, same thing as saying that every day you should light a candle and give these certain chants.
Yeah.
And I mean, there's ceremonies that, the Hindu ceremonies that have been incorporated into Buddhism that do just that,
mm-hmm.
as these rituals. And of course, that now you're putting the weight on the flame and the
mm-hmm.
chant
mm-hmm.
as your deliverance,
yes.
rather than realizing that it's your thinking that's why the Buddha starts and ends with right view and wrong view,
mm-hmm.
and it's just that clear. It's either a wrong view or it's a right view,
yeah.
according to a Buddhist teaching.
Yes.
If you want to believe something, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the important thing here is that the Buddha taught something very clear and direct, that is very well focused and at the same time all encompassing, because it deals with the truth of the reality that we're living in. But it deals with it in a direct and discreet way, rather than in a general and confusing and all-inclusive way. It's all-encompassing, but it's discreet. And that's a thing that many people have a difficulty with understanding. It needs to fit in that again, that reconciliatory view that an ignorant mind has. To need to have things fit its view before it can accept anything is the essential problem. And so the Buddha taught this eightfold path so that we could recognize those views, and if we're willing, to let go of the views and develop right view.
And whilst you were reading it, I realized that, during my life, I have tried to explain what we do here to different people. And I've never put their questions into a category. But when I think about when people are not interested in what I'm saying, that's the reason why. It doesn't fit their beliefs and their category, and they ask the questions that are not relevant to the whole process of why they get stressed.
That's right.
The questions are not appropriate, which is forgivable, because I don't know what the Dhamma is anyway, but you can understand the questions that when I try to just talk about the Dhamma to people outside, sort of thing, that's the problem, that they ask the wrong questions about the Dhamma and they don't understand what the Dhamma is and what it's trying to teach you, that they ask other questions.
Yeah, and those questions are infinitely variable, but all have the essence of ignorance at their core, or the question itself wouldn't be. Again, that's why the Buddha wouldn't answer the questions. He could certainly, anybody can answer these questions, in a speculative way. One of the great Buddhist teachers, Nagarjuna, made a living out of answering those questions. In fact, that's really all that he taught. He wrote extensively, and I read him extensively, and it's some of the most mind-blowing but mind-numbing stuff you'll ever read, because it's so circular. And he keeps trying to make this point of it's all one thing and it's all nothing, because it's all one thing. And I thought that was the essence of the Dhamma, so I studied it for years trying to figure out where is he going, and because he has a reputation as being this great teacher still today. And that was really one of the last forays I made into, and I'll call it ignorant Dhamma, until I came across with the Buddha. And the contrast between, Nagarjuna was around the 5th, 6th century, a modern Buddhist interpretation, and recognized as one of the great masters, Nagarjuna, and what the Buddha actually taught, the difference is striking if you put them up side by side. And it's so telling that an awakened human being taught something that is not circular. It doesn't allow itself to go towards speculation and continued ignorance. It gets right to the heart of the matter. But that's the problem. A mind that is, the Buddha would often use the analogy of a closed fist. I'm not like a teacher with a closed fist. I don't hold something back. A mind that is not willing to look completely at what's occurring is a mind that is closed, because it's a closed fist. It won't allow anything else to come in that would force it to look at its views. Mm-hmm. So it comes up with all kinds of different scenarios and modes of practice that if enough people would do it, then it must be good. It must be good to go. And those same problems were there during the Buddha's day. They arose in the first council and every council subsequently. The councils were formed to hopefully protect the Buddha's teachings and maintain them throughout the ages. They did a pretty good job of it, except there are always people that wanted a different Dhamma. And that's fine. It's fine in the sense that it's all part of dukkha. The world is a perfect vehicle, and again, the Buddha describes it, for the continuation of dukkha, and the systems within the world that have developed in that way. That's simply what's occurred. It was, and you know, another, when you look at it that way, and you realize that the conditions of ignorance are exactly the same today, and the results of those ignorance is exactly the same today as it was 2,600 years ago, you can truly say that these Four Noble Truths are truths that last throughout time, because they're not attached to the truths themselves are not attached to any wrong view. And so a view that is a right view of reality that takes into account impermanence continues as a right view. And so then you really get to understand the true power of now, meaning there's no such thing as now. We're always in a continuing process of becoming. But if we can find a way to be present with what's occurring, rather than distract ourselves by wrong views and rituals that take us out of what's occurring, even the ritual of I need to continually process these great questions, or other rituals such as lighting candles and chanting or dancing around or anything else, or bowing a million times, those are all distractions. They don't do anything to address the problem of wrong thinking. And anything that reinforces wrong thinking, such as catch-all phrases, etc., is just going to continue to prove it to be a distraction. And the Buddha, in his great compassion, but the more I understand him, I keep using the word this great courage that he had to stand up. He was a human being. Though awakened, he was still a human being. And he was continually, literally on a daily basis, excuse me, Diane, having to stand up for what he believed in and what he taught, because he was questioned on a daily basis. And when you look at his suttas, every one of his suttas was geared towards taking a mind that is rooted in ignorance and turning it away from that ignorance and turning it towards the Dhamma. And that's all he taught. He could have easily fallen into the trap of all the other spiritual teachers. Especially, now here's a man who grew up a prince in his father's kingdom. He was used to luxury and wealth and recognition and power. And within a few weeks of his teachings, he had 1,000 people following him. He could have easily fallen into the ego trap of, man, I got it. I'm the greatest there is in the world, and now all I need to do is to keep this going. And he didn't do that. He was never concerned about building followers or anything. This is the Dhamma, and this is what I teach. And when he had students that went out and started teaching, and he found that they were embellishing the Dhamma to fit their other people's views, he called them back in and said, you foolish man, what you're doing is for your detriment and the detriment of everybody you're coming across. Why? Because it continues ignorance. Very great insight to see that. Anything else?
Not really. The only thing I've sort of noticed in my, when I meditate, sometimes a pattern occurs where I am thinking of something else. This is when I start my meditation, I am thinking of something else. But I just have a feeling of my breath, but I'm thinking about something else. And it's almost like watching TV in the hope that you fall asleep. The distraction of thinking about something else relaxes your mind. So then, and then eventually the distraction will fall away and you just focus then just on the waving of your breath, you know, just the in and out. And you sometimes you can almost use a distraction of a thought to calm your mind.
With the intention of coming back to your breath.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, not the intention of coming back to it, because you have to acknowledge it all the time you're thinking about something else. You have to be aware of it.
Yeah.
And eventually the thought, what you're thinking about, will fade away and you're just left with the awareness of your breath.
Yes, and the reason why I say, and you have the, because the underlying intention coming into meditation is to do just that, to recognize when you're caught up in your thinking and come back to your breath. And so that's what you do, because you've set your mind to do that.
Yeah.
Again, it's so important. If you decided in your practice, just to go back to that, you know, just the metaphor I was using before, that when you find that you're self-distracted, light a candle and chant. Okay, that's going to take your mind away from that distraction, isn't it? But it's going to do nothing about deepening concentration. Or you could say, when my mind is distracted and I just can't relax, I'm going to go out and hit a few tennis balls. Well, of course, if you enjoy playing tennis, that's a relaxing thing to do, isn't it?
Mm.
But it doesn't do anything for deepening concentration. Mm. And it doesn't put you within the Dhamma.
Mm.
It doesn't establish you. It's great insight to you.
But I had previously thought that when you're thinking about something, you had to concentrate on kicking it out of your head and getting back to your breath. It's like, no, can't think about that, thinking about my breath. And it's, I don't use it like that. You can use it as a distraction to quiet your mind, and eventually it will fall away. And so you don't have to put any energy into not having thought. Am I getting a bit too... This is just how my mind works anyway sometimes. And as I say, it's a bit like watching TV and then falling asleep. The absence of thinking, watching the TV, puts your mind at rest. Although people say that screens keep you awake, but you know what I mean? It's...
Yeah, no, I do.
I'm not talking about the Dharma, I apologise, but it's just something I sort of notice when I'm meditating, that I don't have to not think about what I'm thinking about. I just need to think about my breath.
That's right.
And keep in contact with that. And everything else will sort itself out.
Yeah. So if you... The other way, the circular way of thinking that I have to not think,
yes,
is that same thing,
yes,
that caught Nagarjuna and everybody else. It's,
yes,
circular thinking.
Yes.
How can you not think? It's,
yes,
you are thinking.
Yes.
Come back to your breath.
Yeah.
And you mentioned, I think this might have been a couple of years ago, that you saw your breath is here. It was a good picture,
mm-hmm,
and your thoughts were down here.
Mm-hmm.
So your thoughts, our thoughts are constantly flowing. That's,
mm-hmm,
the reason why I say over and over again, that meditation is not about developing a trance-like state. That's,
yeah,
it's possible. I mean, we could all, you know, in a few minutes, I could have us all sitting in a trance-like state by suggestion. But there's no useful development of concentration.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't teach it. The Buddha doesn't teach it. A lot of people teach meditation as the goal of emptying your mind.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's often presented, and you know, we hear a lot of, that's what meditation is. It's about emptying your mind. It's not about emptying your mind.
No.
It's about being at peace with your mind.
Yeah.
Period.
That's it. Yeah.
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 That's the ultimate goal of the Dhamma, is to be at,
yeah,
peace with your mind. So,
mm-hmm.
Great insight.
Thank you.
Diane, good morning. Thank you for your ride. And how is your... any questions or comments?
I'm fine.
Thank you. All right. Our retreat is coming up Thursday. So there won't be a Thursday or Saturday class next week. I'm planning on streaming the retreat session, so I may. We'll see how that works out. But we will have a Tuesday class next week, and I will give a Wednesday talk too. We'll finish as we always do with metta. So again, find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of the arising and passing away of your breath and your body. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
Thank you, John.
Thank you. See you Tuesday.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.